Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, November the 2nd, 2017. 13 minutes coming up on 14 minutes past the hour. Scott Spears along with you for the ride today. I do want to give you a couple programming notes here. Tomorrow morning, Friday morning at 11:10 a.m., a special edition of the Now program with everything going on in Washington. We could not possibly fit it all in this week in our normal program. So tomorrow we'll have a special program, 11:10 a.m. in the morning with Eleanor Clift from the Daily Beast, former panelist on the long-running TV series, The McLaughlin Group, as well as former writer for Newsweek magazine. But Eleanor Clift tomorrow with the Daily Beast, talking about everything going on in Washington. And also, don't forget, next Tuesday, election coverage, live election coverage, 7:10 p.m., running through all the elections called that night. Terry Tackett will be at the Board of Elections. Linda Sims will be at Democratic and Republican headquarters, and Charlie Evers and Sean Kraft and myself will be in studio. So it will be one heck of a night, as election nights always are. Now, shifting from all of that to today, our guest, what can you say? He's one of my favorite people. He's been on with me countless times. He is a true pal. Anytime I call him, he is willing to do the favor and come on. And what a day to come on. 2 years, two World Series that go to Game 7. And if you haven't heard, if you've been living under a rock, last night the Astros did defeat the Dodgers in California. A lot of sad people in California last night in Game number 7 of the World Series, 5-1. Now here are two interesting tie-ins. Our guest today, who I haven't introduced yet for a purpose, lives in California where the game was played and was born in Brooklyn where the Dodgers originally came from. And he's the best sportsman you'll ever find, and you probably know him best from HBO Boxing. What more can you say? Larry Merchant. Larry, how are you?
I'm doing splendid. It rained this morning, and I just assume the heavens were crying for Dodger fans. But the Astros overcame heavier rains to win it all. And, hey, it was the best World Series since the last one.
What is going on, Larry? When did the World Series become exciting again?
I'm not sure. This one will be long remembered for the 13-12 game, a kind of game I've never seen in spring training, much less in a World Series, because of all of the comebacks and the home runs and whatnot, and it was sort of symbolic of the new era of baseball, the way the game has changed, with the bigger, faster guys hitting the ball farther and farther, and not caring about whether they ever strike out or not. So it's like all other games; it's changed, and we saw it come to a dramatic climax in the fifth game of the series.
You know, Larry, last year the Cubs did beat the Indians in Cleveland, but the Cubs were on quite a roll. They'd come back from a 3-1 margin, and even though it was an amazing extra innings World Series, I thought the Cubs were going to win. I think most people did. Last night, being in California, Tommy Lasorda being 90 years old and being involved with this, it just felt like the Dodgers were going to win. It just seemed, last year, I'm sure the Indians fans were upset, and they were, but people said, my goodness, it's been a long time for the Cubs. Last night seemed a little more depressing, did it not?
Not to me, really. I just wanted to see how it all played out. After a playoffs and World Series, you seem to know each player's teeth brushing habits and how they move and what they do, and I just wanted to see the game and how it would be different from all other games, as all games are. Incidentally, sitting behind home plate was Larry King, who is from Brooklyn in my high school, and Sandy Koufax, sitting 15 or 20 rows away, who went to school with Larry King and my brother. And so I had some kind of a personal connection to what was going on. But unfortunately, I really was born in the Bronx, and I was bred to be a Yankee fan, even when we moved to Brooklyn when I was 10 or 11 years old. And but I outgrew that, you'll be happy to hear. And I just loved the game and was glad it ended on such a high note, in including a proposal for marriage.
I bring up Tommy Lasorda because he entered the news this week because he is 90 now, and there was a celebration of his 90th birthday, and the Dodgers, his team, are in the World Series, were in the World Series. And he said, he was being honored, he said, "Thank you for the honor. May God bless each and every one of you, and if the Dodgers don't win this time, I think I'm going to kill myself." Sad day for Tommy Lasorda.
Well, he's the former manager and way back a pitcher for the Dodgers who used the term bleeding blue for the Dodgers, and it's been his life. So I can understand that feeling. It's like the extreme feeling that a fan has, which are far more extreme than you and I and a lot of ink-stained wretches and journalists and so forth. But I couldn't be happier with the World Series. I think the Astros are a terrific team and a delight to watch, with wonderful players and personalities and who play with great enthusiasm. And I think that's another new thing in baseball, is this passion that players are unafraid to show today. And that's an outgrowth of how the game was played in the Caribbean. I once watched a game in Cuba, and it was the most amazing experience. It was like going to a musical and a baseball game at the same time.
There is one more Tommy Lasorda quote that has seemingly made all the papers today, probably because the Dodgers did not win, but apparently he had some advice for manager Dave Roberts. In the quote, I can't say on radio, but I'll try to fill it in here. "You haven't done," begins with an S, and you can't say it on radio, "until you win Game 7 Wednesday." Lasorda told Roberts that, is that a true statement? You're only as good as your last game?
Not really. I mean, there's a body of work. Now, Tommy Lasorda was the manager when the Dodgers won the last World Series, and their last World Series in 1988, I think it was. But Roberts has proved to be an excellent manager in the new style of managers and metrics and their connections with the front office and all of that stuff. And I'm sure he's going to build a body of work over time that will stand the test of time.
Larry, this happened after Tuesday's press conference. How does something like that happen? Could that throw you? I mean, as if the guy needed any more pressure yesterday.
I think Roberts takes it in the stride of ball players. Ball players are raised in a world in which there's more failure than achievement on a daily and even in a season basis. If you get one hit out of three, you're not only a star, you'll be in the Hall of Fame Well, that means you failed two out of three times. So ball players are inured to defeat. They understand the game. They're disappointed when they, of course, when they lose big games, and when the seventh game of the World Series. How can you not be? But how many teams ever get that far? I mean, that's a pretty good achievement, and the Dodgers have a lot of young stars who can look forward to more postseason play. I just think that Tommy Lasorda, who is an after dinner speaker, three of the worst words in the world, by the way, just as putting it all out there and representing the fans, because I think fans who commit their hearts have such strong, long-term feelings, understandably feel that if you get that far, what's the point if you don't win the last game?
The Indians and the Cubs are teams last year. We all thought we were going to see a repeat. The Indians, something happened to them early on, and the Cubs in the playoffs went south too. What happened to them this year?
Well, look, in the modern era of baseball, and of all sports for that matter, in which there are playoffs, meaning you're going to have to play series against other really good teams, it's much more difficult to win these things. And then when you win it, it's still more difficult to win it again. The Giants won three World Series in 5 years some years ago, which is an extraordinary achievement in the modern era of the game. But it's really, really hard to repeat, to go all the way when you're going to be facing elite pitching day after day after day for a month, and you have to survive that.
The World Series, for a long time, close to 20 years, was not a ratings bonanza. The ratings are in this morning. Now, last night's game did not deliver what last year's game did. It was down 25%, but 31% of the televisions on last night watched the game, compared with 39% last year. Are we getting new baseball fans, Larry?
I don't know. One of my prized possessions is a gold pass from the Baseball Writers Association that allows me into any ballpark in America. And so occasionally if I'm in some other city and there's a ball game, or occasionally out here in Los Angeles where we have two teams, the Angels and the Dodgers, I go to ball games. And I'm often surprised by how many young people are there. So I don't know how all that works out. I think baseball is having a kind of advertising crusade to appeal to kids. Maybe the dangers that have been exposed about football will bring more people, or more superior athletes like Judge of the Yankees, these big, and Stanton of the Miami, these home run hitters who are big and fast and athletic, the way few ball players have been in the past. So how things change over the next generation? Well, if we look back, change happens faster than ever, and it accelerates, and we don't know where all this is going, but baseball's had a very good run for the last few years, and the ratings in general, I think, for this series, I've heard, were pretty darn good. I don't know what it all means in the infinite scheme of things.
It's an interesting time, because at some point, football surpassed baseball, and then it really surpassed baseball, and baseball was kind of thought as an afterthought. In this two-year duration where the World Series has gone to Game 7 and drawn more than a quarter of the country, basically, because everybody has a television now, I would say, to these games, and last year almost half of the country, and football at the same time is wrapped up in a scandal with this flag kneeling, is there a chance for baseball to sneak back in and get some of that advertising money? Is football even being hurt by the
scandal? I don't think that there's any evidence yet of football being hurt as a commercial enterprise. When you look at the salaries that ball players are making, somebody is watching. Somebody is paying all that money to the teams and the leagues that reflect an interest in the game. Houston goes out and signs Verlander with a month to go in the season. He's got 3 years left on his contract, and it's, I don't know, worth, $70 million? There's interest. How they divide all that up and so forth, and which game gets more, and don't forget basketball, which is also a very, very popular game, and basketball players' salaries reflect that, as well as football and baseball players. So we have three big games, and people care passionately about it. Incidentally, one thing I should point out, the four teams that reached the finals of the championship series this year came from the four biggest cities in the country: New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Houston. And sometimes that reflects the revenues that they generate locally, whether it's fans buying tickets, whether it's radio rights and local television rights, etc. So, hey, it's we live in a amped up world where everything gets multiplied and then multiplied again, and the day may come when people laugh at the idea that players only made $20 million a year.
Something that fascinated me yesterday with all the World Series buzz, I went to a couple people actually, and I said, "What is your favorite sport?" And they both said football. And I said, "Okay." I said, "Now name some historic figures in baseball and football." And they all named the Jackie Robinson, Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, Hank Aaron, even though that was not their favorite sport. Now, when it came to football, somebody said Joe Namath, and there are people. He's still living. What is it about baseball and its characters that are different than football? Or is football just not old enough yet?
I don't know the answer to that. Baseball players, first of all, baseball for 100 or 150 years was the only game, and it was that mattered. And it started to throw a little baseball, a sponge ball or so, when they learned to walk virtually. So it was somehow deeply embedded in our popular culture. And, of course, it's an individual game, and there are so many games every season and so many opportunities to see the superstars that every generation had. So I just assume that has something to do with the connection with individual great players, but I'm sure generations from now there'll be different feelings about athletes from different sports. I don't know that our millennial fans know who Red Grange was, much less other great football players. In part, I think it's ball players as such. The game allows you to be a personality. The focus can be on you and on an individual who's not wearing some kind of armor around him with a helmet, and you can hardly see who he is. That's one of the factors that has maintained the game.
And it is interesting that presidents, celebrities, come and throw out the first pitch. Not a lot. Haven't seen that, you know, the coin flip in football. That's not really happening.
Well, I don't think you see many politicians going to ball games to have themselves seen anymore. Fans are as likely to boo them out of their seats as they are to cheer them.
When it comes to the history of baseball, a lot in recent years, of course, has been made of Jackie Robinson with the release of 42. You saw Jackie Robinson play, did you not?
Many times.
What made him different? I watched a biography on him over the weekend, and what a life. A lot of things I didn't know about. Civil rights activism.
Well, they, you know, Branch Rickey, Ohio fella, one of the great innovators in the history of the game, invented the minor leagues and so on, was the one who, I mean, baseball people knew that black ball players playing in the, what were called the Negro Leagues of the day were capable of playing in the big leagues. They barnstormed in the off season. Some of them became well-known, like Satchel Paige, and so on. And so when Jackie Robinson was picked, a guy who had been an officer in the Army, a great college athlete, is a track star, a basketball star, a baseball star, ball star. Maybe the greatest athlete this country's ever had. And, of course, when he entered the game, it was a revolution. It foretold the civil rights revolutions that would follow him. And he was just an outstanding ball player. I'll tell you a little story because I just have to. I used to play, I played high school football, and we played many of our games in Ebbets Field, the home of the Dodgers. In the last game I played in high school on an undefeated team, I ran for a long touchdown at Ebbets Field. And when I got into the end zone, this was in 1947, the year that Jackie Robinson broke into baseball, and he broke in as a first baseman. I entered the end zone along the first base, which was along the first baseline at Ebbets Field. And it was about my first or second thought. This is where Jackie Robinson played. That's how profound a figure he was in the game to me personally, even if I wasn't a Dodger fan. He was a focus of attention. He played with the Dodgers for a decade. They suddenly became a tremendous force in the game where they had never been before. They became the second most profitable franchise in the game, only behind the Yankees. And, of course, he's still a force. Just the other day, I ran into a woman in a parking lot of a supermarket who was carrying a number 42 jersey with the name Robinson on the back that she had purchased for a child of hers, and I told her that I had seen him play in my first year of covering Major League Baseball. It was his last year. I had met him. He was an intelligent man and an activist in his day, and incidentally, a Republican. I think the Republican Party has changed a little since that time.
I think you're right. To meet Jackie Robinson, what was the man like? What did you ascertain, aside from the civil rights activism and it being intelligent, what most struck you about the man, the guy you had watched play?
Well, I was in such awe of him that I remember going into the Dodger dressing room. It was after a game. It was not specifically to interview him, but I didn't know what to say to him. I didn't know what to ask him. He hadn't starred in that game or done anything, and I just walked by and nodded, and he nodded back at me. And he's a great historic figure, not just in the game, but in our culture, because the game meant so much.
Do you ever think there'll be anybody who surpasses his sheer bravery? I mean, I think that's what you have to say it was. Is there anybody
his
bravery? Is Muhammad Ali on par with him facing what he did?
I think in his own way, yes. I think Ali was such a, not just a great athlete like Robinson, who was quietly activist, because those were different days. But Ali was an activist at a time of general activism in the country, and although athletes were not supposed to do that, he did that and got away with it because he was, although he was punished as well, when you take a chance to be an activist, you're free to do so as an athlete or entertainer, but there could be consequences, and the consequences for Ali was that he was embargoed from the sport for 3 years during the war in Vietnam. So, and there have been others. Listen, Billie Jean King is a historic figure. For what she did for not just women in sports, but for women in general during the feminist movement, she is huge. Now, tennis is not huge like baseball, but she is an extraordinary figure of our times.
It's interesting because these two figures, Ali and Jackie Robinson, did live in the same time, Robinson dying in the early 70s. And he did comment on Muhammad Ali's stance against against going to war. And this is what Jackie Robinson had to say, just a little moment in time. This is Jackie Robinson on Muhammad Ali.
To fight for freedom, for being
Well, I think that he's hurting, I think, the morale of a lot of young Negro soldiers over in Vietnam. And the tragedy to me is that Cassius has made millions of dollars off of the American public, and now he's not willing to show his appreciation to a country that is giving him, in my view, a fantastic opportunity, hurts a great number of people.
When you hear that, that's Jackie Robinson, by the way, listeners. What do you think, Larry? You knew both men.
Well, it was not an unusual viewpoint back in that day. There was a war. There were American soldiers being killed. It took a lot of gumption to stand up against the establishment, but there was an anti-establishment period in the late 60s and 70s that changed attitudes about a lot of things, civil rights, women, the government, and so on. It didn't surprise me at the time, because he was, oddly enough, on the spectrum of political viewpoints, a kind of down-the-middle conservative guy. And interestingly enough, it's the same argument being used about the athletes who don't sing the anthem or salute the flag in public. Hey, our system is maybe imperfect, but look at all the money you're making because of it. Why are you being so critical of it? It is an argument, and but people sometimes do extreme things to bring attention to their causes.
Being with HBO for so long, you seem to me to be such a great... I used to think of you like the human editorial with your questioning, because it was great what you would say. Were you ever forced into doing something you didn't want to do because, hey, HBO is paying you the big bucks?
Well, I was very, very fortunate. I had a boss whose name was Seth Abraham, who once told me, you caused me a lot of problems, Larry. He was talking about negotiations with managers and promoters who might not like what I said about them or their fighters, and they would bring it to him. He'd get the calls for what I did. And Seth Abraham said to me, keep doing what you're doing. He took the heat. His attitude was, if there's a difficult call, just make the right one.
You know, it's
not what's right for me or the network or somebody. Just make the right call, or what you think is the right call. So I was very fortunate. I wouldn't have been there for 35 years if I didn't have people up top who were willing to take the incoming, because they felt that what I and others did at the network in terms of programming, etc., gave it an edge. That was a big selling point for the network. And look, wherever I've been, I was a columnist for many years in Philadelphia and then in New York. Sometimes you're throwing a brick through a glass window, and there can be consequences, and you're not always right. I wasn't always right. But you make errors, you play the game.
For my money, the best call you ever made, and I think I've said it before, for personal reasons, one being Columbus, Ohio, just shortly up the road here, when Buster Douglas defeated Mike Tyson, you're lying, this makes Cinderella look like a sad story, but because of the internet age, in the interview you did after, if people can pull that up, it's you can't play it, unfortunately, on the airwaves because there's some guy saying profanity in the background, but it was okay for HBO, but it's a great interview you did with Buster Douglas. But the Mayweather thing, because it came toward the end of your relationship with HBO, do you think it led to the end of your tenure there? And being paired with him, if you search Larry Merchant, that's the picture in the video you get.
excuse me. I don't know. What I do know is that we got new head of our sports department, somebody who succeeded Seth Abraham, and there was someone between the two of them. And I had a meeting with him. And this was after the Mayweather incident, months and months, and maybe even longer, I don't recall. And he was a lawyer. He was a corporate politician, and he said to me, you think you can take it down a little bit on Mayweather because we're in a negotiation for a long-term deal and so on. It could mean millions of dollars to us. And I knew at that instant that I was not long for his world. What happened was that while he was negotiating with Mayweather, I ended my contract prematurely. I went to them and said, look, I don't want to wake up every morning thinking I'm defying my daddy that day. If this guy wants me to bunt, and I don't know how to bunt. And so we arranged, so my contract, which would have been up in about a year or so, I don't recall, we negotiated the end of it. They paid me in full. I agreed not to make a big deal out of all of this. And the PS to the story is that months after I was gone, the contract negotiations with Mayweather imploded, and Showtime got him. So whether or not I directly or that infamous line of mine directly or indirectly led to the end, I don't know, but it led to the end in the sense of that's who I am, that's who I was, and I wasn't going to spend the rest of my career defying a boss who couldn't stand the heat.
Let me ask this way then. If that moment had not happened, you saying what you did to Mayweather, do you think you'd still be with HBO or would have been with them longer?
No, I would have been gone. I mean, look, I 35 years on one show with one network. You know, they come and you know what? I'm going quietly into the good night. I've had my career here. I've had my careers elsewhere. Life will go on. Boxing will go on. And enough is enough. And I left. And I think it pleased him, and it pleased me at the same time.
Well, do you think you would have fulfilled that contract if that hadn't happened?
Yes. Well, probably. Because that was, I mean, the background noise is that Mayweather had issues with many writers, broadcasters, Brian Kenny, who you may know, who was at that time doing boxing for ESPN, because he didn't ever want to be challenged because of various reasons about his personality, his personal life, which he used to help promote himself, his style as a boxer, and so on and so forth. There weren't a lot of true believers, and so I was just one of them. But I was the guy doing his fights. Well, you know, so it goes. I'm just a footnote to a footnote. I always felt the fight is the star, the fighters are the stars. I'm just there as a kibitzer and then as a senior kibitzer.
In all the years you did fights with HBO, because that was an extemporaneous moment, now that you look back on it, I remember we had you on the day after, and it was extemporaneous and everything was happening. You became a viral video for a few days there. What happened?
Yes, I had a grandson who told me that I was outdoing Justin Bieber.
TMZ was at the airport waiting for you. You were a star. Did he do that?
15 seconds.
I think yours has lasted a lot longer than that. But do you think he did that on purpose? And your response, you never really responded like that, that I can remember, to anybody. What do you think
happened? No, because, the story, as I finally digested that moment and remembered what happened, was that he ended the fight by hitting his opponent, Victor Ortiz, with what was a legal sucker punch. In some disputatious moment, the referee had went to speak to the timekeeper, and Ortiz put his gloves down and his eyes trailed the referee, and the referee hadn't called time, and Mayweather hit him twice and stopped him, and it was legal, but it was still a sucker punch, and the crowd was in a very excitable moment. It was explosive, volatile moment, and as I started to interview him, the volatility reached the crescendo, and Mayweather, who is very shrewd about all of these kinds of things, very smart, understood immediately that he was going to be castigated for what he did. And he had an emotional outburst that was personal. Have you ever seen an athlete who may not have liked the question or not saying to a broadcaster, "You don't know Esh about boxing, HBO should fire you"? So that was not about the fight, not about what was going on in the arena directly. It was a personal attack. And I counterpunched. And both of them, I don't think neither side was planned. But it was in there someplace. There had to be reason for it. But it was intuitive. And it just happened. I wouldn't even be smart enough to have planned something like that. And it's my thing. But you mentioned the interview with Buster Douglas after he upset Tyson. To me, the best interview I ever did, or the most important, was that interview, because Buster was so overwhelmed emotionally by what he had achieved, in light of the fact that his mother had died a couple of weeks before, and he couldn't speak. And I just held the mic there, because I knew that I'm in the game of show and tell, and that seeing him wanting to communicate but unable to, trying to gather himself for like 20 or 25 seconds, which is, as you know, like hours of silence in all of the noise of what we do. That, to me, was the best thing I ever did.
It absolutely was. And just for anybody,
just to stay there and let it play.
Oh, in his
get hand. Out of the way. You know, this to me, the story is not about me, although inevitably it can become that in television. The story was about the fighter and the fight.
It was. It's an amazing moment, and people can watch it on. It would behoove everybody to watch The Fight, which is on YouTube if you haven't seen it. It's an amazing moment if you understand who both of those men were at that time. And that interview at the end where he just can't speak, and people are trying to pull him away, and he's trying to speak. It's amazing. But just for those people who are tuning in and might not follow this, the response that Larry gave to Mayweather that we have talked about was, if I were 50 years younger, I would kick your keister, and Larry did not say keister. Where do you think that line came from?
Where do I think it came from?
Yeah, was it just...
Well, it came from, you know, I tried to think of other occasions when that might have happened during my career or before, and where we all just blow, and part of it was a person. I was being personally attacked at a moment of high or low drama, and I had said nothing in the interview that would have inspired that. It was his response to the 20,000 fans who were in an uproar over what had happened, and I was the one he could also hit with a sucker punch. Where does it come from? I don't know. I thought of a time when I was at Oklahoma as a last string halfback, and we were having a tackling drill, and we were lined up against the first stringers, and it was one-on-one, and the coaches said, well, we're only going 75%, we're not trying, and after the first or second go-around, I noticed that the other guys were going, the first stringers were going full speed. And so when my next came up, I hit somebody who happened to be the quarterback, and I raised him on my shoulder and I dumped him on the ground as hard as I could. And some assistant coaches started yelping about it. And just again, instinctively, I said, shoot far. If he hits me, I'm going to hit him. And I walked back to the end of the line, and I saw them muttering under their hats, smiling in a way, because they knew what they were trying to do and that I wasn't going to take it. So there's some element in me that when things aren't fair and they reach some, or when I think they're not fair and they reach some high point, something came out. And incidentally, in my household, the problem, while they were getting off, this is what I was told later, while they were getting off the floor after I made that remark, the argument was whether I should have said, if I was 50 years younger. And so the argument was grammatical, that I should have said if I were 50 years younger, which is the proper grammar. And it was decided by a friend of ours who said, well, in street talk, I was 50 years old. If I was 50 years old, it's perfectly good.
I love it. Larry, there's never enough time with you, so I'm going to throw you a long pass with a minute left. is Donald Trump going to make the end of his presidency after what we've seen so far this week?
Well, he's gone a lot further than any of us or many of us thought he would from day one. So I don't see any reason because that he won't make it, because his biography is full of occasions in which he just delayed. He with lawsuits and so on, which he just delay has always been his go-to operatic Monday, and so he'll find a way to delay it and to fend it off, and probably to survive, especially because his party feels they can use him to pass legislation that they want, although they haven't gotten there yet, a year after his election. And because there is a base of about a third of the electorate who doesn't care what he says or what lie he tells every day, and or how divisive he is, there's that political calculation in everything he does, and so. I have no reason to believe he won't survive, but the bullets may be, that come at him may be more and bigger than we know of right now.
What can I say? If I were 50 years younger, I couldn't enjoy this interview any more than I enjoy it today. It is always an honor to have Larry Merchant on. As I say, always great, always comes on. It's a joy, Larry, and may it continue forever. May we press the same delay button that Donald Trump has pressed all these years and delay it to maybe we'll get another 7 games.
Well, at least until after the next great World Series.
Sounds great. Larry, thank you so much. Talk with you soon.
Thank you, Scott.
Bye-bye. And I'm done. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
You don't listen, God will get you for that.
This is Margaret Hazlett, and you're listening to WWGH Radio, .1 FM.